Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Does the EU Empower Environmental NGOs? This talk is delivered by Dr. Michael Briguglio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Tonight we are very happy to welcome Dr. Michael Briguglio. He will be giving his seminar to the Work in Progress seminar series on the topic, Have Environmental NGOs Been Empowered Through Malta's EU Accession? In his presentation, Dr. Briguglio will discuss whether the EU has influenced civil society empowerment in Malta with specific reference to environmental NGOs. Dr. Briguglio has a PhD in sociology and lectures in the sociology department of the University of Malta. His main sociological research interests are politics, social movements, environment, culture, and social policy. And he has published various academic papers in these spheres. He's well known to many of you as a left-green activist since the mid-1990s. You're getting on now, Michael. It's some time now. And he is, as many of you know, a member of the SLIMA Council for the Alternativa Party. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much. My presentation basically is based around my PhD thesis, whereby I studied environmental NGOs with respect to Malta's EU accession, and I focused on the first few years following Malta's EU accession. So basically this study focuses on the years from 2004 till around 2009 or 2010, depending on which case study I'm going to speak about. It took me quite a long time to carry out this research. In fact, I had lots and lots of newspaper cuttings, box files full of newspaper cuttings, because I analyzed various issues. They also interviewed all the environmental NGOs. And my role in this study was also as an activist sociologist, or a sociologist activist, because I myself have been involved in various environmental issues since I was a student. For the past 20 years, I've been involved in various environmental campaigns. In fact, my first thesis, my undergraduate thesis, was called State Power Hiltonopoli, and it was about the Porto Mazo project. So basically, I followed the tradition of Marx and feminist sociologists and other similar sociologists who believe that the sociologist should take a stand in the issues he or she is analyzing. However, being a sociologist, the sociologist has to be systematic in his analysis. This is a tradition which was initiated by Karl Marx, but later on other sociological traditions like feminism and even various environmental sociologists have taken up this approach. So basically, the focus of the study is to analyze whether EU accession has influenced civil society empowerment in Malta, and I focus on environmental NGOs. My focus is specifically environmental NGOs. So I'm not referring to political parties, I'm not referring to citizens in general, I'm referring specifically to environmental NGOs, and as I said previously, I am examining whether Maltese environmental NGOs have experienced empowerment in the first years following Malta's EU accession. So the study focuses till the years around 2010 or 2009. The main research questions of this study are the following, namely whether EU accession has affected the lobbying of environmental NGOs, whether EU accession has enhanced the empowerment of environmental NGOs, and whether EU accession has led to the institutionalization of environmental NGOs. I will be speaking about this later on. Yes, before I move on to the theoretical background, I would like us all to remember that before Malta joined the EU, when there was the pro and against. When there were these two campaigns concurrently, the yes and the no campaigns, the yes movement had much to say about the environment. The yes movement said hunting is going to stop in Malta. We will no longer have mega construction developments. Big business developers will no longer be as powerful as they are. We will have better roads. Well, a lot of arguments were made before we joined the EU on waste management, for example, and on many other issues. And basically, the environment usually was used by the Yes campaign, by the Yes movement, as an example why we should join the EU. And basically, in this respect, I believe that the environment is very much of a political issue. You cannot look at the environment in isolation from politics. Here, I'm not interested in the environment as a biologist or as a chemist, but I am interested in the environment as a sociologist. So I look at the political dimension of the environment. I strongly believe that the environment is as political as is the economy, for example. And in this respect, I used an approach which is very much influenced by Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe. In fact, I would like to dedicate this presentation to Ernesto Laclau, who passed away just a few days ago. He was actually participating in a conference in Spain. So I borrowed their post-Marxist discourse theory, which is sometimes known as discourse theory, and sometimes it is also referred to as a branch of post-structuralism. And their approach is an approach which David Howard, who was the external advisor of my thesis, refers to as an approach which gives primacy to politics. So I look very much at the political processes related to the environment. So I look at how environmental issues were articulated, how they were articulated in society, how they were brought up in society. For example, how different movements spoke about a particular environmental issue, or how, for example, the same term is given different meanings by different groups. Okay, as I said previously, before we joined the EU, the environment was articulated in a way where it seemed to be beneficial to join the EU for the environment. And I also looked at how chains of equivalence are formed. What are chains of equivalence? These are rather loaded theoretical terms which are used by Laclau and Mouffe. Chains of equivalence refers to political alliances, basically. When you have political alliances around a particular issue which is politicized, for example, before we joined the EU, there was the front against the golf course in Rabat. I was very much involved in that front. And a chain of equivalence was formed where you had different groups which had different interests. However, they formed an alliance with the scope of protecting Rabat from the development of a golf course. So you had, for example, radical environmentalists like Movement Graffiti, moderate environmentalists like Nature Trust. You had different political parties like the Green Party, and for example the Labour Party was also opposing the Rabat golf course. You had farmers, even some hunters were opposing the development of a golf course in Rabat. So you had a chain of equivalence, and in this study I look at how chains of equivalence were formed around different environmental issues. And I also look at how nodal points are constructed. What is a nodal point? A nodal point takes place when a particular issue is given fixed meaning. For example, sustainable development is a nodal point. It is a term which has fixed meaning in society, relatively fixed meaning. Why is it relatively? Because no sustainable development for a politician before the election is not exactly the same as sustainable development for a radical environmentalist, for example. However, the term sustainable development is floating within society, so it is a nodal point. And in fact, this is what I look at in my study. I look at how different environmental issues were articulated in different ways and how alliances were formed around different issues. So, for example, on hunting, which I will speak about later on, a nodal point was created around hunting and the abolition of hunting in spring, for example. That was a nodal point. And then I also look at hegemonic formations. A hegemonic formation takes place when a nodal point is formed and when social change actually takes place. So, for example, if hunting stops in Malta, which is something which still has to be seen, if hunting in spring stops, we can say that there would be a hegemonic formation on that specific issue. However, Laclau and Mouffe are influenced very much by Gramsci, but their approach towards hegemony isn't a macro approach. They're not speaking about a holistic social change. They speak about hegemonic formations on specific issues. So it is more of a micro approach. Okay, so I look at hegemonic, I analyze whether hegemonic formations were formed on specific environmental issues, whether environmentalists were successful through Malta's EU accession of changing things with respect to various environmental issues. And I then made use of other theoretical concepts which have nothing to do with Laclau and Mouffe, but which are used by some sociologists who analyze environmental movements, particularly Chris Roots and others. Basically, they say that environmental movements, and we can apply this to all social movements, in fact, are successful when they have one or more of these four impacts: sensitizing impacts, procedural impacts, substantive impacts, and structural impacts. What are they? Sensitizing impacts usually are impacts which have to do with raising public awareness, with raising public consciousness. For example, today many of us are aware of the climate change issue. Yesterday we learned, for example, that the melting of ice caps is something which is irreversible. And the Washington Post actually had a very strong article on this. So when we speak of sensitizing issues, we are speaking about public awareness. This is one type of impact which environmental NGOs usually have, the sensitizing impact. Usually it is the easiest type of impact to obtain. Then there are procedural impacts. Procedural impacts have to do with, for example, a change of procedures, which involves environmentalists in this case. For example, if government decides to consult with environmental NGOs, for example, Malta's Environment and Planning Authority has what is known as a nature group. The nature group, at least on paper, had actually a nature group, had, but during the course of the study, the nature group was in place, had a nature group where environmental NGOs were consulted officially by MEPA on specific issues. That is an example of a procedural impact. Or, for example, the government has a climate change committee. Here I'm not going into whether the committee is effective or not, but in terms of procedure, environmentalists are consulted, which is different from when you had environmentalists who were beaten up in the streets, for example. There is a change. Okay? So a procedural impact has to do with formal procedures which involve environmentalists. And for example, in the run-up to Malta's EU accession, certain environmental NGOs were also officially consulted. Then you have structural impacts. Structural impacts have to do with either a change in the structure of environmental NGOs, or else a change in governmental structures. For example, following Malta's EU accession, two environmental NGOs were born, the Ramblers Association and Flimkien Al-Ambjent Aħjar. That was a structural impact. You had new environmental NGOs. You can also speak of structural impacts which have to do with environmental NGOs changing their own structures. For example, NGOs like Nature Trust and BirdLife became much more professional in their approach. But structural impacts also have to do with, for example, new structures like a ministry for the environment or a ministry for sustainable development. We don't have one in Malta, but all EU member states have a ministry which is involved in environmental matters. That is a structural impact. And then there's substantive impact. This is the most difficult type of impact. A substantive impact has to do with a substantive change. For example, if environmentalists in Malta manage to stop spring hunting, that would be a substantive impact. When environmentalists in 2004 managed to stop the development of a golf course in Rabat, that was a substantive impact. Okay, so substantive impacts are the most difficult types of impact. Then I used another concept, which is used by Tania Borzel and by others. Tania Borzel has also written a lot about environmental movements in the EU, when she uses the concept of the EU as a gateway for empowerment. Tania Borzel notes that especially when it comes to environmentalists from Southern Europe, they tend to use the EU as a gateway for empowerment. They don't manage to convince governments or local authorities on certain issues, so then they resort to the EU. They resort to the EU. In this study, I tried to say whether this was the case, and when it was the case, whether it was effective or not. Then I used other theoretical concepts. One was dislocation, used by Laclau Move. Dislocation means when you have a sudden change, which causes a certain type of rupture. For example, Malta's EU accession, in my view, was represented a dislocation. Malta entered a new realm, a new legal framework, and so forth. Overdetermination is used by the Marxist philosopher Althusser. Overdetermination means that in any particular context, there are various factors which are influential. The economy is definitely one of them, but there could be other factors, cultural factors. Perhaps Althusser here sounds a little bit like Max Weber, but Althusser still argues that when we speak of overdetermination, economic inequality still plays an important role. And in fact, in this study, I showed how the economy did play a very important role. Environmental class conflict, which is used by Layfield, this means when environmentalists have an adversary which has to do with economic power, for example, big business. Now, in certain environmental issues, this is definitely the case. In others, as I will show later on, this wasn't the case. Institutionalization, which is used by Chris Roots, institutionalization has to do with, for example, with co-option of environmentalists. For example, the state could give give posts to certain environmentalists, or land is handed to environmental NGOs to manage. They are given money, they become professional, but in the process, they lose their radical edge. They become much more in conformity with the state, institutionalization. And they analyze that as well. And the state is a condensation of antagonistic forces. This is another Marxist concept used by Nikos Polanzas, where the state is relatively autonomous from the economy. Even though the economy is very much influential as regards the state, you still have a lot of conflicts going on. For example, in an issue which I didn't analyze in this thesis, in the cement plant issue, even though the big business was very much heavily involved in this issue, one of the biggest developers in Malta, ultimately, the environmentalists managed to defeat big business. So the state is a condensation of forces. This is a much more flexible concept of power. I'll move to the methodology now. In line with Laclau's and Mouffe's approach, I used what is known as the Essex School of Discourse Analysis. This is a specific type of discourse analysis, where basically I look at the discourses which were produced by environmentalists and by their adversaries. The discourses used by bird life on hunting, for example. The discourses used by hunters on the hunting issue. The discourses used by ministers, who very often try to give the impression that they are mediating between different interests. So I looked at, when I say the environment is a political issue, from a methodological perspective, I look at how the environment is framed, how it is articulated, how an issue is articulated by different groups. And groups are never equal. Some groups are always more powerful than others. I interviewed respondents from practically all environmental NGOs. I will refer to that later on. And I also made use of case studies, the case study approach. I made use of four case studies. I couldn't look at all environmental issues, because otherwise I would still be writing the thesis right now. In fact, I had box files full of newspaper cuttings, which I didn't use because of the word limit and so forth. So I made use, I had four case studies, but one case study in turn was represented by a further three case studies. So, as regards the way how the methodology was applied, the first type of methodology, research method, which I used, is known as elite interviewing. This is used very much in political sociology, where you are interviewing persons who you consider to be experts in the field. An expert doesn't necessarily have to be somebody who has a doctorate, but if I am analyzing environmental NGOs, in my case, representatives who environmental NGOs nominated were considered to be experts for my study, because they were speaking about the area in which they were directly involved. So there were 14 environmental NGOs at the time of my study. Some of them still exist, some of them do not exist. And they asked them to nominate two representatives each who would be interviewed separately. And I had a target number of 28 respondents. Effectively, I interviewed 24 because one environmental NGO disbanded whilst I was carrying out this research. It was in Salvao with Garnau, which has recently risen from the dead. Okay, one environmental NGO only sent me a reply in writing, so that was one respondent, and another environmental NGO agreed to send two respondents, but they came together instead of having separate interviews, and only one of them spoke, so I considered that to be one respondent. But practically, I interviewed all environmental NGOs except for one which no longer remained active at that particular time. The interviews were carried out in summer 2009, okay? And these were the environmental NGOs which I interviewed. Nature Trust, BirdLife, Friends of the Earth, Dean Lart Helwa. Those are they were established, the eldest NGOs. Then the radical NGOs, Graffiti and Zminietna, the new NGOs, Flimkien Għall-Ambjent Aħjar and Ramblers. Then there was BICREF, the Biological Conservation Research Foundation, which is a small NGO, Gaia Foundation, then some local NGOs, Hondo, Kwisisana, Residents Association, the Committee Against the Recycling Plant in Marsa Scala, and Save with Garnau, which no longer was active at the time. Now one may ask, why did I choose, for example, Graffiti and Zminietna? I happen to have been or am active in both. Because, first of all, they have been involved in many environmental issues. They were also part of MEPA's nature group, when we speak of procedural impacts. And they have been consistently active, basically, in environmental issues. Now, one may ask, why didn't I decide to interview, for example, the organic agricultural movement? I had to draw a line somewhere. The organic agricultural movement was active in various environmental issues, but not systematically. Now, one can say that local NGOs were not systematically involved in all environmental issues, but they were systematically involved in their specific environmental issue. Somebody asked me, why didn't I interview hunters? Because hunters consider themselves to be conservationists. Again, you have to draw a line. Even though these NGOs represent diverse interests, they have something common between them. I think if I would have analyzed, I would have interviewed hunters, I might as well have interviewed trade unions, because trade unions, for example, are interested in health and safety, which is an environmental issue. So somewhere I had to draw a line. Basically, I chose environmental NGOs which were systematically active in a number of issues which were articulated in a particular way, namely to protect the environment, for example. Then I also made use of case studies. Case studies have to do with specific issues. David Howard says case studies enable the grammar of discourse theory. What is a case study? I looked at how various issues were articulated in the press. I made use of two leading newspapers, The Times and Malta Today. I chose The Times because it is the more institutionalized newspaper, and Malta Today because it is a newspaper which is more sympathetic with the environmental movement. So I try to balance them out. Through newspaper coverage, I tried to see how environmental issues were articulated in civil society. Okay, so I wasn't only interested in what environmentalists told me through their interviews, but I was also interested, I was very much interested, in fact, in the way how environmental issues appeared in civil society. And I chose newspapers as a medium through which I could carry out research. So I analyzed text, basically. And the case studies which I chose were the following. I chose these on purpose, now I will say why. I chose hunting and trapping, the fishing of bluefin tuna, climate change, and development projects. I chose hunting and trapping as an example of an issue where the EU has clear regulations, so I try to choose a Europeanized issue. But it is also an issue which is very controversial in Maltese politics. Climate change, I chose it because it is a relatively new issue where the EU at the time of this research, was framing its approach. However, it doesn't feature very much in local politics compared to hunting. I chose bluefin tuna because it is an issue where environmentalists in Malta are not very active. However, global environmentalists have been very active, including in Malta, such as Greenpeace, and later on the Sea Shepherd Society. And I chose development projects because they are usually the most controversial environmental issues in Malta. However, I'm speaking this on hindsight and also from my experience as an activist, development projects are those issues where the EU has basically doesn't have a lot of directives on which environmentalists can resort to, basically. So I try to make a mix of different issues with different types of activism and different types of legislation. As regards development projects, I chose a macro case study, which was the rationalization process in Malta, the so-called rationalization process. But then I chose two specific projects in Sliema, which were very close to each other, Fort Cambridge and the Quisisana car park, yet which had very much different results, basically. And I was also involved in these issues, in the latter two issues, also as a local councillor. So basically, case studies provided me with a lot of data. As I said, I had box files full of data. And I also used them to verify whether what environmentalists told me was actually what was seen in civil society. So I triangulated the two types of research methods. So as regards the case studies, and my PhD focused mostly on the case studies, okay? I tried to see whether hegemonic formations were formed on the specific issues, whether a hegemonic formation was formed on hunting, whether a hegemonic formation was formed on climate change, and so forth. And in turn, I looked at these impacts, substantive, structure, procedure, and sensitizing, on each environmental issue. As I said, I used Times and Malta Today, two leading newspapers, which even though sometimes have taken the sides of environmentalists, it is not always the case. And one is more conservative, and another one is perhaps a little bit more liberal as a newspaper. And I'll move on to the main findings. A main finding of the study was that generally, I don't like using the word generally very much, but EU accession has generally enhanced, the empowerment of environmental NGOs. I'm not saying that environmental NGOs were empowered through Malta's EU accession. However, their empowerment was generally enhanced. However, this was an uneven process because it depended on various over-determining factors. Basically, it depended on the issue in question. It depended on the environmental NGO, okay? For example, some environmental NGOs today are in a much better position than they were 20 years ago. Some environmental issues today are perhaps more prominent than they were 20 years ago. But we cannot make a generic conclusion that this was the case. In fact, in some environmental issues, I think we have actually moved backwards and not forward. So this was an uneven process. However, generally, environmental NGOs have more tools at their disposal for lobbying purposes, for example. In fact, generally speaking, environmental NGOs changed certain lobbying practices. For example, they tended to make alliances with other NGOs. They resorted to the European Parliament at times. They wrote to the European Commission at times. Now, whether this was effective or not is something which I will speak about later on. And before Malta's EU accession, there were certain opportunities which weren't in place in Malta. So before Malta joined the EU, for example, environmentalists were not on the same playing field as environmentalists in Italy or England or Germany or Luxembourg. Okay, so environmental NGOs had more opportunities at their disposal. By opportunities, I don't mean that these achieved results, okay? I will elaborate on those findings later on. And something else which I found out, I knew this, but through my research I carried out a systematic analysis, was that there are both moderate and radical ideologies in environmental NGOs in Malta. And I classified environmental NGOs in four different categories. Now, this is, it's a bit subjective, but it is systematic. Not all environmental sociologists use this classification. So there are some environmental NGOs which are local. Usually they are moderate environmental NGOs. They are not seeking radical social change. They don't want a recycling plant next door, for example. Conservationist NGOs, which are more, they are moderate NGOs. What does this mean? They are not after radical social change, but they are very much for the protection of flora and fauna, for example, bird life. Okay, bird life isn't speaking about changing, about the abolition of capitalism, for example, but it is speaking about protecting birds, particularly in spring. Nature Trust is about the protection of green areas and so forth. Sustainable development NGOs, here I put Friends of the Earth as an example, which can be moderate and they can also be radical. However, they are generally more moderate. However, they have more of a holistic approach. For example, Friends of the Earth has also spoken about transport, has also spoken about social issues. So their approach is more holistic. By holistic, I'm not saying it is better than that of other environmental NGOs. However, they are also interested in social justice issues and so forth. And the radical NGOs, like Movement Graffiti and Zminietna, look at the environment as an example of why we need to change the type of system in which we are living. Okay, so for example, for radical environmentalists, climate change is very much related to capitalism. Capitalism is a system which causes overproduction and overdevelopment, and this is leading to climate change. So radical NGOs want radical social change, basically. I also, even though it's not written here, I also classified NGOs in terms of size. For example, some conservationist NGOs are rather big, like BirdLife and Nature Trust. Others are rather small, for example, BICREF. Okay? The radical NGOs are small, for example. From my interviews, I found out that conservationist NGOs were generally the most optimistic regarding empowerment. Usually, from their replies, respondents from conservationist NGOs like Nature Trust, Ramblers, Flinkin Al-Ambientahiar, BirdLife, usually they were the most optimistic. Doesn't mean that they said that since we joined the EU, we have solved all our problems. However, they were the least critical of the EU. They looked at the EU as an ally, basically. They were the most optimistic. Sustainable development NGOs were rather optimistic as well, though this wasn't always the case. They were also critical at times. Radical environmental NGOs were not so optimistic about Malta's EU accession and empowerment. They were rather critical. However, the least optimistic and the most pessimistic were local NGOs. The local NGOs were very much they were very skeptical about Malta's EU accession with respect to their specific issues. Okay, so for example, they told me EU accession has not solved anything. We have written to MEPs, but this wasn't effective. There are no rules which we can use to protect our specific issue and so forth. Okay, so local NGOs which were moderate were even more skeptical than radical NGOs. So being radical being moderate doesn't necessarily mean that you are optimistic about Malta's EU accession. Moderate local NGOs were the most skeptical. Yes, this I have already spoken about this. So basically, when it comes to the case studies, I looked at whether, as regards each case study, whether these impacts took place, sensitizing procedure, structure, and substantive, and whether intern hegemonic formation was formed. And a generic conclusion, now I will specify on each case study, was that empowerment through hegemonic formations was not common, okay? So what does this mean? That even though environmental NGOs were perhaps had more opportunities than before Malta joined the EU, they did not manage to form hegemonic formations. So basically, they were unsuccessful in being victorious on various issues, basically. Okay, so for example, on hunting, BirdLife today has much more opportunities than it had in 1985. However, hunting is still taking place very much. Okay, but one cannot say that BirdLife is in the same situation as it was in 1985. It is a much richer environmental NGO. It has much more land to manage. Okay, it resorts to European institutions and so forth. However, it has not managed to form a hegemonic formation. Hunting is still taking place. In fact, through my case studies, I found out that only on one issue a hegemonic formation was formed. However, environmental NGOs were successful in constructing nodal points. What does this mean? That they were successful in stabilizing meaning on certain issues. For example, today, many of us speak of spring hunting. A nodal point, a discourse on spring hunting was created. Today, we speak about climate change. We speak about overdevelopment. A nodal point doesn't mean a substantive impact, doesn't mean that you have changed something, but there is public consciousness. There is a meaning which is relatively fixed in society. In fact, I found that environmental NGOs were tended to be most successful in terms of sensitizing issues, sensitizing impacts, namely raising public awareness, and on procedural impacts. On paper, environmental NGOs are being consulted. Okay, and especially before elections, you know, we have ministers and press conferences and so forth. But on paper, procedural impacts are taking place. And environmental NGOs have managed to create a public discourse on various environmental issues. I found that environmental NGOs were most successful. Doesn't mean that they have managed to change things very much. As regards climate change, now what does this mean? I myself believe that we have done too little too late on climate change. However, environmental NGOs were successful in creating a signifier, a nodal point, on reducing CO2 emissions. And at the time, the target of environmental NGOs, remember I'm speaking of the years 2004 till 2009, was that Malta, the target of environmental NGOs was that Malta has climate change targets. Okay? Now, at the time, environmental NGOs were successful in lobbying both on at a Maltese level and also at a European level, and Malta agreed to have targets of, for example, 10% renewable energy and so forth. Now, on hindsight, we know that these targets are very difficult to obtain because of lack of action from governments. But in the time frame 2004-2009, environmental NGOs were successful in having they had a substantive impact here because Malta committed itself to targets, basically. This was the area where environmental NGOs were the most successful. They had procedural impacts, substantive impacts, and the discourse on climate change was created. The discourse was based on two ideologies, sustainable development. In fact, you had environmental NGOs, both at a Maltese level and at a European level, speaking of the need to create green jobs, for example, to have environmental and social priorities together, and ecological modernization, which speaks of modernization through technological methods, which is green at the same time, like, for example, renewable energy and so forth. At the time, environmental NGOs were successful in this respect. In fact, the EU in 2008, this was before the Copenhagen summit, the EU agreed on certain targets. However, today we can say that the EU has not managed to reach these targets, and the approach taken by the EU now is much weaker than it was at the time. I'm specifying that I analyzed up to the years 2009-2010. Okay. However, here environmental NGOs were successful in articulating discourse also through their lobbying with the EU, whereby Malta committed itself to reach certain targets. When it comes to development projects, the EU had absolutely no, I wouldn't say absolutely, but had very little impact, basically. In fact, the nodal point which was most successful on development projects was that which was used by government and by big business developers. Basically, that we need development for economic growth to create jobs, and the neoliberal ideology, which says we should allow business to flourish, basically. These were the most influential discourses, and not the discourses of environmental NGOs. Here, environmental NGOs made use of what is known as environmental class conflict. Their adversary generally was big business. So here, even though many believe that when we'll join through Malta's EU accession, the environment would be protected, when it comes to development, there was in fact, we keep on developing as if we have an endless supply of land. Let me go back to development issues. On development issues, I analyzed the rationalization process. In fact, on the rationalization process, there was a new legal framework which could have made a difference, which is the Strategic Environment Assessment, the SEA Directive, I think it's called. Yes. However, the Maltese government at the time introduced legislation just before Malta was obliged to follow the SEA Directive, even though I believe it wouldn't have made much of an impact. In fact, when it comes to the other development issues which I analyzed, namely the Kusisana car park and Fort Cambridge, I found that environmentalists were most successful when the EU had no say, basically had no say at all on the Kusisana car park issue. Environmentalists resorted to the EU. However, the European Commission wrote back telling them it has absolutely no legal remit on the Kusisana car park. However, here environmentalists were successful in stopping the car park, mainly because they allied themselves with a local member of parliament, Robert Arrigo, who was very successful in articulating a discourse to stop the Kusisana car park. So the reason why the Kusisana car park was stopped was very much a political reason. It had nothing to do with EU. In fact, just 200 meters up the road, there was another development taking place, Fort Cambridge. The EU forced MEPA to carry out an environment impact assessment. However, it had no impact because Fort Cambridge was developed. So this even shows even more how the EU has basically very little impact on development of land. On bluefin tuna, again, this was an issue where Maltese environmental NGOs were not very active. You had Nature Trust, which spoke a little bit, BICREF, which spoke a little bit. However, you had global NGOs, which were very active, including in Malta. Greenpeace were active, World Wildlife Fund, and later on, the Sea Shepherd Society, famous for freeing bluefin tuna and taken to court for doing so. Here, the adversary of environmentalists, apart from big business, so again, you had another example of environmental class conflict, was the discourse used by the nationalist and labor parties, even on a European level. They spoke of the national interest. They said Malta needs the bluefin tuna industry for the national interest because it provides a lot of income for the Maltese economy. So when you had ministers meeting at the European Council of Ministers, the Maltese Minister for Fisheries used to say Malta cannot agree with a reduction of quotas on bluefin tuna because it goes against the national interest. So this was the most powerful discourse, the discourse which wasn't used by environmentalists, which was used by both major political parties and also by big business. The national interest and, once again, the neoliberal ideology that we should allow big business to flourish, basically. However, bluefin tuna, unlike hunting, which I'm going to speak about soon, even at an EU level, bluefin tuna isn't characterized by a strong legislative framework. The EU doesn't have a strong policy framework on bluefin tuna. It doesn't have a birds directive on bluefin tuna. So this made matters even more difficult for environmentalists. And then there was the hunting and trapping issue, which I define as an unresolved issue. And I personally believe that even if a referendum takes place, I think it will still remain unresolved. Now, this is a very interesting issue because here there is a very strong EU legislative tradition, the Birds Directive, which is one of the oldest environmental legislative frameworks of the EU. And many, including myself, believe that once Malta joins the EU, hunting in spring will finish, will stop. However, this is not the case. So what am I saying here? I am saying that one shouldn't simply adopt a legal perspective to analyze environmental issues. If one simply adopts a legal perspective, one looks at the Birds Directive and stops there. This is very much a political issue. Here you had an issue where hunters are very important political players with respect to Malta's two big political parties. Okay, so EU accession isn't the be-all and end-all of environmental issues, even when you have a strong, a very strong legislative framework. This is even more the case because environmentalists in Malta are now resorting to a national referendum because the environmentalists are noticing that this issue ultimately has to be solved within Maltese politics. So BirdLife Malta, which was the main protagonist on hunting, used the EU as a gateway for empowerment. BirdLife is a much richer environmental NGO. It is a much more professional environmental NGO. It has very strong allies like BirdLife International. The European Green Party has always supported BirdLife. So in this respect, BirdLife was empowered as an NGO. It is in a much better position than it was in the 1980s, where if you were a BirdLife supporter, you might have been beaten up, perhaps in the streets. At least that is what some environmentalists say. However, they didn't manage to solve the issue, basically. So here, environmentalists created a nodal point on spring hunting. However, the pro-hunting lobby was organized very much on a national level, and once again they used nationalistic discourse. They said Europe shouldn't interfere. For example, they were very critical of BirdLife's Turkish director. They referred to him as an adversary. They used imagery from the Great Siege and so forth. They used a traditionalistic discourse. They said hunting is part of our tradition. Okay, so just look at how environmental issues are articulated in ways which are not necessarily environmental. They refer to tradition. And they also used a very confrontational tone. For example, when one particular statement, Hunter said that if spring hunting will stop, the party which stops hunting will lose 10,000 votes, for example. Something which is very interesting once again in this case study on hunting is that here there wasn't a big business adversary. The adversary of environmentalists wasn't Malta's main land developer, neither was it Malta's main exporter of bluefin tuna. The adversary was an organized political lobby. So what I'm trying to say is that even though I personally think that the economy is very important when you carry out analysis, you cannot simply say that the economy is always determinant. In this issue, it wasn't. There were no economic interests involved. What you had here was a political struggle, and hunters were very much successful in articulating a discourse through which hunting in spring remained in place. Something else, which I wasn't written down over here, but which is very important, is that even though the EU has a birds directive, when the matter was taken up by the European Court of Justice, the conclusions of the European Court of Justice were very vague. Both hunters and environmentalists said that they were victorious. Very similar to the Malta referendum, when you had the yes and the no lobby. Yes. So again, you cannot explain everything through law, because here you had the European Court of Justice concluding in a way which was interpreted differently by the different protagonists. So this is an unresolved issue, even though there is much more consciousness on spring hunting. Another finding which I found has to do with institutionalization. Previously I said that institutionalization has to do generally with co-option. So, in simplistic terms, you have an environmental NGO, government gives it land, it appoints some of its members on governmental committees, they become professional, however, they stop criticizing the government. Things aren't so simple. For example, BirdLife has become institutionalized. It is officially consulted by the EU. It is officially consulted by the government. It forms part of the Ornis Committee. It manages public land. It has professionals. However, BirdLife is still antagonistic towards the state on hunting. So what am I trying to say? Even though environmental NGOs can become institutionalized, this isn't a simple one-way process through which environmentalists just shut up just because they are gaining funds. In the case of BirdLife, at least, BirdLife is a good example of how you can be institutionalized and antagonistic at the same time. Yes, this is why I'm referring to BirdLife, because you can have other examples where some environmental NGOs perhaps are much more moderate than they were 10 years ago, which I think is the case as well. What I am trying to say is that there are different shades of institutionalization. Bird life is an example of an environmental NGO which is in and against, so to use a Gramscian term. Okay? Then you have other environmental NGOs which are basically in, and others which are against, which are not institutionalized. In fact, the radical and the local NGOs are the least institutionalized. They do not get funding from the state, they are consulted much less, and so forth. So basically, environmental, the radical and the moderate wings of the environmental movement create what Neil Carter, an environmental sociologist, refers to as a creative tension. Both environmental and radical NGOs have been very much, have created this tension between them, through which various environmental issues were articulated. Sometimes even within the same environmental NGO you can have this tension. For example, I had some interviewees from some NGOs which differed. Some were more radical, some were more moderate, and so forth. So basically, to conclude, my main conclusion is that empowerment is an uneven process. You have unevenness amongst environmental NGOs. You cannot say that there is one uniform, holistic movement. There is unevenness as regards different issues. There is unevenness regarding different impacts. Okay, so when I say environment, the empowerment of NGOs was enhanced, I am not saying that environmental NGOs were empowered through Malta's EU accession. I am saying that in certain aspects, there were examples of empowerment. In others, there were examples of institutionalization, but this had no effect on a specific issue, and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael, for a very wide-ranging talk, backed by some very interesting theory. You've covered a lot of ground, and I'm sure different people in the seminar want to ask you different questions. I'll just open up with a very, very, very broad question. You have distinguished between, among impacts, between sensitizing impacts, procedural impacts, structural impacts, and substantivist impacts. I don't think I'm saying anything particularly original when I say that it looks like clearly your findings are that the main impacts in terms of EU empowerment were when it came to sensitizing, or when it came to procedures, or when it came to structures. When it came to actual substantive change, we find there, of course, environmental NGOs seem to have been least successful as a result of the EU. Now, that clearly brings up issues about which people will want to talk. I just want to talk about it with respect to one. I'm wondering, listening to this very interesting talk and to some of the literature you put on the board, whether or not discourse analysis and the whole attention of social theory over the last 20 or 30 years to discourse, you know, the whole move away from structural economistic attention to classes, social classes, and economic systems towards looking at discourses, looking at articulations, looking at media, hasn't itself probably been a wrong move. I'm putting it very crudely. It has been a move which is counterproductive, to use a slightly more sophisticated way of talking about it. We've become so hooked on discourse, all of us have become so hooked on discourse analysis, we don't pay enough attention to what's going on the ground. I mean, we find this move was made in sociology, it was also made in my subject, anthropology. The whole move towards the analysis of discourses, culture as discourse, society as discourse. But maybe we need to move back to some of the older, more old-fashioned theoretical approaches, such as, for example, classical Marxism, which of course said, let's look at who has actual power and how it gets used. And because, I mean, just a suggestion to end my question is obviously pretty clear. In a sense, the big boys, and by the big boys I refer both to the EU and to big business, probably have extremely sophisticated lobbyists of their own and advisors of their own. And if they can create niche for NGOs, they will do so. While it's true what you said, that they don't necessarily de-radicalize NGOs when they institutionalize them, to a certain extent, when you create niche for these NGOs, maybe what you are doing is you are de-radicalizing them.
Yes, thank you very much. As regards impacts, yes, definitely. Environmental NGOs were more successful as regards sensitizing impacts and as regards procedural impacts. And they were the least successful with respect to substantive impact. In fact, the only substantive impact which I found in my thesis was on climate change, which arguably isn't even a substantive impact, because the impact which they had at the time was that Malta committed itself to targets, which today we know was basically rhetoric. And that leads to a criticism of discourse analysis, which I will refer to very soon. What I wanted to say is that my findings are in line with findings of other sociologists. For example, Chris Roots, an English environmental sociologist, who is very famous for his studies on environmental NGOs, also concludes through his research that usually environmental NGOs are more successful when it comes to sensitizing impacts and least successful when it comes to substantive impacts. So here my study was very much in line with other studies. On the limits of discourse analysis, I tend to agree with you, but I agree partially. For when it comes to various issues, for example, development, I would say that a more structural Marxist approach would have been fine. For example, when I was an undergraduate student, my thesis, as I said previously, was on the Hilton project on Puerto Mazo, and I used a structural Marxist approach where I basically looked at the relationships between the state and big business and how the developmentalist ideology prevailed. However, you cannot explain everything through the economy, even though personally I give a lot of importance to the economy. For example, on hunting, as I said, the adversary wasn't a big business adversary. The adversary was an organized Maltese lobby, which isn't known for its economic power. It is known for its lobbying influence, basically. However, and I also pointed this out in my thesis, discourse analysis does have its limits. For example, on climate change, Malta obliged itself for certain targets, a 10% target on renewable energy. Through my approach, I could say that was a substantive impact on environmental NGOs. But as you said, if you go on the ground, you will see that was an agreement in rhetoric, basically, because effectively nothing was done, or very little was done, so that Malta reaches its climate change target. And that is one of the... Yes, that is one of the problems of discourse analysis. There was a hegemony, there was a discursive hegemony. Environmentalists were in line with the need to have targets, and Malta agreed with these targets. However, on the ground, and this is something which is very difficult to analyze if you are analyzing text, and this is where perhaps other research methods and methodologies can come in, for example, critical realism, which is different from this constructivist approach. A critical realist approach would have shown us that even though in rhetoric there was an agreement, a legally binding agreement on climate change, effectively when it comes to policies and methods used, Malta wasn't doing anything to reach these targets. And that is one of the limits of this thesis. However, and I'll stop here, in my original draft of the thesis, I actually wanted to introduce a critical realist approach, specifically on climate change. However, an argument was made that it is much better to be in line with one theoretical tradition. So, I tend to agree with your observation.
As for discourse analysis, I would say that this is where academia comes in, where NGOs are concerned. There are very few academics amongst us. All we are, when we speak about overdevelopment, we do it in terms of the environment as aesthetic, as a health issue, and even as an economic issue, but we just stop there. And our opponents are the developers and the big parties. It is economic and it is political. we are not aware of discourse analysis. We are very concrete in our position. I mean, and so perhaps even in this case, academics would give a better push to the environmental movement if they again went back to the old to the old tradition. I mean. As for our empowerment with the EU accession, well, it depends, as you said, on the particular NGO. There are no land use directives in the EU, so ramblers, for example, have very little help in the EU. Once a year, people from the environmental directorate, Poroshkin and not Poroshkin himself, but Madame Blin comes over and somebody else, and we make our grievances. There are several NGOs present, and each of us makes their grievances. And we bring up issues of law, and issues of this, and this of that. Well, sometimes, we have some effect, but most of the time, we feel it is not really effective. Otherwise, we don't see how EU has really enriched ramblers or empowered ramblers, quite honestly.
Yes, I agree with you, especially since Ramblers is an NGO which is involved more in development issues. The findings of my thesis perfectly concur with what you are saying, and I think this is why discourse analysis is important. Discourse analysis is a theoretical and methodological method through which you analyze. You said it yourself. You said we speak about the aesthetic, we speak about the economic need. Yes, discourse analysis carries out an approach to systemize the way how language is produced. Now, on development, the discourse, which speaks in terms of economic growth and so forth, has been more successful. This is what discourse analysis is, basically. You are looking at the way how meaning is partially fixed, and which meaning is more powerful than other. Which meanings are the most powerful? When it comes to development of land, despite Malta's EU accession, despite all the rhetoric we hear, the discourse which is most influential up to this day is the discourse which believes that development is beneficial for the economy and is beneficial for everyone. I don't agree with that discourse, neither do many environmentalists, but that discourse in itself is hegemonic. So as a discourse analyst and also as an activist, I believe that one has to counter such a discourse with a more influential discourse. That is what happened with the Front Against the Golf Course, where the big business developer was saying that the golf course in Rabat would make economic sense. However, the environmentalists against the Rabat golf course, who were allied with farmers, with the local council, there were about 30 organizations involved, created a discourse which was much more influential, basically. And incidentally, Patrick Gaia has a master's degree on the Front Against the Golf Course issue, and he showed how environmentalists articulated a discourse which, against all odds, basically, was more successful. So discourse analysis isn't a question of being concrete or not concrete. It is a question of looking at the way how language is produced in society and how language is not equal. Apparently, on the issue of development of land, which is what concerns Rambler, the discourse which is most powerful is the discourse of economic growth. But that goes back to Professor Klaus' question whether, for example, we can use a political economy approach to analyze that. You don't need discourse analysis. You can look at the influence of big business. And I would say that on certain issues, yes, that approach can very much be the case. In fact, I use that approach for my undergraduate thesis.
I mean, in talking of institutionalization and the effect on NGOs, did you consider political institutionalization? That means a particular NGO having particular links with a particular political party.
Yes, I didn't look at direct links of members in political parties. That would have been very interesting. And there are specific case studies, specific research methods which can do that. What I did was I looked at the way how NGOs articulated their discourse. For example, during an electoral campaign. For example, one very interesting finding which I found was that at the time, BirdLife was very critical of the Green Party. At the time, there is an article which I quoted by Tolga Temyuja, who was the executive director of BirdLife, who at the time said that the Green Party was not doing enough on the hunting issue. Now, one of the founding principles of Malta's Green Party, when it was originally founded in 1989, was to have Malta in line with the Berne Convention at the time. Maybe one can say that bird life was not being so cavalier with the Green Party, which was, after all, its ally on the issue. So I looked at links in terms of discourses, whether environmental NGOs were critical of certain parties or whether they were more supportive of others, and so forth. For example, on the hunting issue, it is definitely the case that hunters made use very well of their links with the major political parties. And this is why I refer to confrontational discourse. They basically threatened the major political parties that if they don't support them, they will lose 10,000 votes, basically. So yes, I looked at discourses which were used, especially in the media. And the example which I mentioned of birdlife was a specific case. Having said that, things aren't the same. In fact, birdlife and the Green Party today are allies together when it comes to the hunting issue. But at the time, Harry Vassallo was the leader of the Green Party. Birdlife was, I would say, overcritical of the Green Party, because the Green Party had actually raised the issue even in the European Parliament through the European Greens.
Thank you, Michael, for sharing with us your insights and research. You said that your methodology was based on two essential methods,
yes.
Elite interviewing and discourse analysis. Did they move in parallel, or were they used to triangulate each other? So from what you have found through your interviews, did it balanced with what you have found through media output?
Yes, what environmentalists told me generally was reflected in the case studies. And as I said in the beginning of my presentation, given that I myself have been active for about 20 years in various environmental issues, there was a certain level of trust with my interviewees. So perhaps they were more open in the way they spoke. And I could also, I knew that they were being honest, because that's one issue. You can have an interviewer who is inventing things. But given that I was active, I knew what they were speaking about, basically.
Or if they were dishonest.
They were never.
You were like an insider. Yourself.
Yes, I was an insider. However, quoting David Howard, who the discourse theorist, the important here is that you are systematic, that your approach is systematic. So I was an insider with a declared position. However, I was systematic in my approach.
So, like a feminist. So the two methods actually triangulate themselves.
Yes. However, the interviews helped me very much in the beginning of my research to identify the ideologies of the environmental NGOs. For example, I asked questions to environmentalists, not on case studies, on their environmental NGO. For example, I asked them how would they define the economy, how the economy in relation to the environment. And for example, some would tell me that the economy and the environment are linked. Some would tell me that we live in a capitalist system which has to be overthrown. Okay, so, and from there I could see whether an environmental NGO is radical or moderate. It wasn't so easy, particularly with some NGOs. You had responses which were both radical and moderate. I had to interpret, I had to categorize. For example, one NGO which I consider to be somewhere in between radicalism and the moderate approach is Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth, even on a global level, is a rather institutionalized NGO, perhaps not in Malta, but on a European level, it is. It is a professional NGO and so forth. However, its discourse perhaps isn't an anti-capitalist discourse. However, it is rather radical. Friends of the Earth speaks of the need of certain changes which go beyond the current paradigm of economic growth, for example. But then there are other NGOs which were definitely moderate. And then that helped me analyze even
so
the case
studies. So surely not a case of generalization. It comes out very clearly in your outcome.
Yes, actually, I think the key word is unevenness.
Unevenness.
Yes.
Well, last question from my end. What about the impact on structural issue?
Yes.
Internal structure. Did the EU brought more resources to their administrative capacity, being small and unresourceful groups?
Yeah, first of all, there were two NGOs which were born exactly as Malta joined the EU. Now, whether it had to do with Malta's EU accession, I cannot say. And I'm referring to Flimkien Al-Ambient Ahyar and Ramblers. And I have no evidence that it was because of EU accession, but it was rather interesting that when Malta joined the EU, you had two new voices, two very consistent voices on environmental matters. Some environmental NGOs definitely changed their structures following Malta's EU accession. They had more access to funding. I think BirdLife is the best example here. BirdLife had more access to funding. It had clear allies, BirdLife International, and it also became much more professional. BirdLife itself has a number of employees who are not, for example, its director at the time.
Again, the typography of the groups comes in again, whether they are local NGOs, satellite groups from parent organizations abroad.
Exactly. So local NGOs had basically, there was no impact on local NGOs, other than petitioning some members of the European Parliament, which was ineffective, basically. Then you had you had NGOs which were somewhere in between, which perhaps petitioned the European Parliament, which had access to some funds. For example, one of the radical NGOs did access some EU funds, but on a particular project. It wasn't something systematic. I think unevenness is the key. However, there are differences between moderate and radical NGOs, and there are also differences between large and small environmental NGOs. For example, Nature Trust, Din Lart Helwa, and BirdLife are definitely the largest environmental NGOs. They were born in the 1960s, they have a longer tradition, they are institutionalized, but even here you have unevenness. BirdLife is institutionalized, however, it is antagonistic, whereas Nature Trust is much less antagonistic as an environmental NGO. Thank you.
One interesting point, I think, which comes out from your talk is that there are limits to the EU. There are limits to EU power. That I think, is very interesting. And the limits are big. That there is meaning to national sovereignty. Clearly, for Malta, issues such as land development or misdevelopment are critical. And there the EU does not have a legal remit.
Yes,
Now there is more point about it. I'm not sure about the necessity of this legal remit, because I am under probably mistaken impression that the EU would rather not concern itself with us, for example, certain aspects of our thing. The question of hunting, the EU has the Bears Directive, but the EU has also the equally legal provision for a derogation. So that's... Now, if it wanted really to be sticky, it would send people here and see that while spring hunting season is properly, shall I say, policed. Okay? No, it hasn't done this. It has been accepting the results from these SMSs, which BirdLife has shown fairly recently have these curious peaks at the last 2 days of the season and this and the other. Anyway... But there are other points. In the last meeting we had with the EU people here, I raised the question about air quality, in which we have to send annual reports to the EU. And the EU had just given us an accolade saying we've reasonably below certain limits for certain air pollutants. And I said, well, part of the problem, as we see it, is that the government informs you, the EU, but it doesn't inform us. Now, could we have, please have a look at the information the government has sent you? There was a sort of reel back in shock, saying, no, this is confidential. We can't just hand it to you. We always write back when they send us information saying we hope they've given it to their own people. I said, well, that's a fat lot of good, as far as we're concerned. I mean, to expect the government to give the information to its own people. And when I subsequently examined, of course, what they send and what are the parameters, etc., I found that it's pretty easy to fool the EU, actually, because say you have a situation like in CEDAW. Now, there is a MEPA box there which measures. Now, one of the rules set by MEPA says that they will not send any measurements unless they are 75% complete. That is, 75% of annual time is the thing is in operation. Okay. Now, all you have to do to put a good picture, say, on MCEDA, is to cut out 1.5 summer months. You don't measure the benzene, you don't measure the ozone. You still send the results to the EU, of course, because that doesn't reach the 75%. That doesn't go below the 75% usage, right? And that's it. But in fact, during that summer period, the conditions down there are absolutely appalling. So, you know, one gets away with it. And the EU, it has limitations. After all, Friends of the Earth, Ramblers, FAA, and somebody else, we've been in court over the rationalization since 2007. We haven't made absolutely any headway. Not one step. We're still...
This is very much documented in my thesis, in the rationalization case study.
We've lost Farouk Jasakko. He's retiring, so his load has been given to somebody else. We've had endless sessions with a judicial assistant, this time and the other. So, in effect, we're not... for example, the EU is far more serious and hard with a place like Italy, so on other issues, with a place like Italy, for example. They get threatened every day of the week. They get fined every day of the week. Actually, twice a day, we get fined twice a day of various major sins that they commit. But it's been, in this sense, it's again a bit disappointing, particularly from the even from this information point of view. Because governments here, unfortunately, tend to, it's still going on. I mean, if you take this business at Mastercard, for example, there's been no government report whether the major breakdown has been put right, what caused the major breakdown, how much it cost to put right, whether it was covered by insurance, absolutely nothing. So they may have started again. We don't know if the methods they're using are still the ones that caused the breakdown, for example. And the other point that I'm not sure about is this question of the climate change and limits, because I don't think NGOs had anything much to do with that. I mean, they were imposed basically by
the No, NGOs. But there was a lot of lobbying at a European level, and Maltese NGOs were very much involved in this.
All right, but in a sense, the EU couldn't say, no, we're not going to put any limits on water, that's too small. They couldn't say that.
No, but in the climate change issue, I made use of the term where you had conflictual consensus. Environmental NGOs wanted more aggressive targets.
Yeah.
However, they were in agreement with the EU, which wanted to set targets.
Yeah.
So there was an example of conflict and consensus at the same time. Yes, and environmental NGOs... this was very much of a Europeanized issue. It wasn't very much of a national issue.
Exactly.
So Maltese environmentalists very much rode on the bandwagon of European NGOs, like Friends of the Earth, which was very much...
that's one advantage.
Yes. So this was... In fact, I used the climate change issue as an example of a Europeanized issue, very much to the contrary of development of land.
Yeah.
For example. And so basically, to go back even to one of the theorists whom I mentioned, Nikos Polanzas, power is everywhere. It's not a question of joining the EU and power is at an EU level. You have power at a national level, and the state is a condensation of conflicts. So I think the environment is an issue which will remain unresolved. It will always be politicized, and it's not a question of whether we joined an institution or whether we have this law here or this law there. Ultimately, it is a political issue, and power plays an important part. But as Foucault says, for every power there is resistance, and there are many examples where environmentalists were effectively successful. The front against the golf course is an example where environmentalists were successful despite Malta's EU accession. In fact, much of the lobbying took place before we joined the EU.
Yeah. Right, Michael, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation, and thanks to the audience for a very interesting discussion.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Does the EU Empower Environmental NGOs? The talk was delivered by Dr. Michael Briguglio.